You don't own me. Don't try to change me in any way. You don't own me. Don't tie me down, 'cause I'd never stay.
It's time for the Daily Review, a podcast dedicated to reviews and discussion of TV, movies, and books. Look for us at Daily Review on Facebook and Twitter and dailyreview.com on the web. That's DaleyReview.com.
This is Paul Daly here with my wife, Caroline.
Hey, guys.
And today we're here to talk about the 9th episode of The Handmaid's Tale. This one is called The Bridge.
I looked up the definition of bridge just because I thought, you know, these titles are pretty straightforward, but there got to be a little bit more to them. Of course, we all know bridge. A physical bridge comes up in this episode with Janine. But also, I thought the second definition of bridge was actually more interesting. It was a connecting transitional or intermediary phase or route between two adjacent elements, activities, conditions. So working at the hospital was a bridge between medical school and private practice. I feel like Janine and her, this entire Janine story is the bridge for June to go from, I'm going to say, go from Offred back to June and go from, you know, the handmaid's mentality of I'm just trying to survive to like, no, I'm going to get proactive and start doing something about my situation. It's not necessarily that this episode is the bridge. I don't mean it like individually, like this episode is it, but I just think that Janine herself and her condition and everything from the beginning was really like her catalyst along the way. And every time things got worse with Janine, Offred became a little bit more strengthened to find a way for the entire group to get out of this situation. I think because Janine is such a, and I don't mean this in a negative way, but a pathetic character. I mean, she's so naive. She's so confused. You know, she was injured the most of this current group. Like, her physical deformity is the most of this particular group right now.
Right.
I know we have Off Glenn's situation, but I'm not going to count her in this sort of like current segment of our handmaid's
right
situation. I know other ones that Jezebel's and stuff were hurt, but this current group, like, she's just the one that represents like the most wounded bird kind of character. Every time she flounders, that's when I see more strength in June. It's kind of, I think it's that protective mama bear kind of instinct. You know, you see somebody having a problem and suddenly you're more willing to speak up, not for yourself, but because of someone else.
Funny you should say that, because this episode, as I was writing it up, is clearly about three different women with a little kind of like a coda for a fourth one. This one is can be broken up into Janine, June, and Serena. And in her own way, Serena also crossed a bridge.
She was in a different place, for sure. I completely agree with you. I think that, you know, the saying, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. I very much feel like this was a situation where when Naomi is nasty to her, it's sort of like she has no choice anymore but to start facing the music about what is really going on in her own household. It's time for her to cross the bridge. Like, they've gotten to it. She's got to deal with what's going on.
I think we should start with June, because her story is more or less the backbone to everything else. And then let's talk about the other women.
Okay, let's go for it. Let's start with June.
We get to see another handmaid ceremony, the weird farewell corridor.
You know what it reminded me of? A lot of times they have put the handmaids in the position of like a cheerleading squad, whether it be at the birthing day or whether it be having like circling up and stuff like that. I was a cheerleader at one point in time, and all the different sort of quote unquote formations that they take remind me of a cheerleading squad. Even at one point in one of these episodes, Aunt Lydia said something like, mind your spacing and stuff. Like, that's totally something that people say, your coaches say. But in this case, this really felt very like the MVP was going to come down the corridor, and the cheerleaders were on both sides, like they do at football games, you know, and they're supposed to be like, good job, yay, nice work. And they're like, praise be, blessed be, saying the same kind of mumbo jumbo cheerleader kind of comments.
This group is pretty down in the mouth, though.
Well, they're not. No, I mean, nobody's ever. I'm not saying they're cheerful. I'm saying that they are put in a position. Saying praise be is supposed to be cheering.
I guess.
Their whole world is drab. So I feel like this is a situation where just take our entire existence, take the football game, take everyone cheering, take the entire situation and then put like a giant wet blanket over it, you know, and then be like, okay, so it can be exactly how I described, but of course it's going to be like this sad, drab kind of situation.
It's also kind of symbolic of just the continued confinement that they have to provide to each other. Like, you follow this path and it takes you to the van. Mm-hmm. That's all you get to think about, do or see.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Like, she can't make a run for it.
June gets Lydia's attention. Lydia is such a mystery to me still that I thought she could turn around and give her the old, you know, cattle prod across the face just for piping up right then. What did you think was going to happen before it played out?
I was nerved up too. I thought as soon as she called out to Aunt Lydia, I thought like, oh, I don't really think it's a really good idea to get her attention, especially in front of everyone. I think I would have tried to find a way to either maybe ask Aunt Lydia to come closer, or maybe I would have taken a couple more steps towards Aunt Lydia and just maybe kind of just tried to whisper, because the way that it played out, it was basically like she was trying to ask if Janine was okay. And that seemed like an acceptable question to ask. Like, Lydia wasn't like, how dare you? But she did make an example out of her and be like, she's stronger than you think. You know, why don't you take
her? Let her be an example to you.
Yeah, let her be an example to you. So, but I feel like she did that because all eyes were on her. All eyes were on them in this conversation. Mm-hmm. And had maybe that conversation been had a little bit closer to each other, maybe, just maybe, it would have been a little bit less for show. Just maybe. I don't know. You're right. Aunt Lydia's part of her, the scariness of Aunt Lydia is her highs and lows. It's like you don't know when she's going to freak out.
You think she's bipolar? I don't. I think she controls it all. I think she does have some kind of psychosis or something, but I don't think it's that. I think it's all under control.
That's a good question. I don't really think that she's bipolar, because like you said, that implies that it's really out of her hands. I just think that she's an extreme person. So I think that everything she does, she's doing on a level that most of us are like, geez, I could never like dial that back about 5. And that's how like a regular person could possibly exist. She's just more, she's like larger than life for everything.
All right, so on the way out, June believes that this is an excellent opportunity to talk to the handmaid we know as Alma about Mayday. And Mayday, we don't know anything about just yet. Avglen has mentioned it. The former Avglen, we'll call her Emily because that is her given name, mentioned it to her in a previous episode and has been kind of biting at June. The seeds are planted, I guess, at this point. But Alma's like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Which at first kind of freaked me out, honestly, but then I understood, you know, later that it was like, oh, okay, like, yeah, I mean, you can't possibly talk about it when everyone, right, and Aunt Lydia,
we're surrounded by everyone,
and the black van is like, you know, a couple feet away. Like, this seems like a really bad time to bring it up. But also, I mean, you have very few opportunities, seems, to actually be around the right people. So it was understood. So it ended up being on a later shopping trip when Alma mentions that, okay, like, I've actually got something that you can do, and, you know, you can get this package from Jezebel's, and she needs to get to the bar and see Rachel, which all of this seemed like, hokey smokes, how are you possibly going to get yourself back to Jezebel's, back to the bar, find the right person? I mean, this seems like a daunting task to me.
It did seem far flung.
So what did you think about the way that she manipulates Fred to get back to Jezebel's?
It is completely within the character that June has crafted to be this person that the commander thinks she is, to manipulate him like that. Thank you for taking me to Jezebel's. That's all.
She definitely does this weird whisper voice that I noticed in this one that was like hardcore. Like, she only talks like, thank you so much. Like, it's very whispery. Now, part of it is that house and the fact that obviously they're not supposed to be in that office together and, you know, all those kinds of things in the house, the way that it's always dark and closed off and stuff. I can't figure out if it's meant to be just scary like that, or if it is a situation where the resources are sort of more limited, and so they're more about like conservationists, so they barely ever have like lights on and that type of thing. I really noticed it at one point when Serena was like doing some knitting And it was like so freaking dark in her room that I was like, oh my God, there's no way that I could do anything in the dark like this. Even Scrabble would be like a little rough to play.
By candlelight?
I think so. I think it would be pretty rough. I mean, everybody from a kid to a grown man, anyone talks softly, more calmly. Like they don't want to intimidate the other person at all. They want to absolutely act like the other person has the upper hand all the time. I feel like she got better and better at that during this episode about recognizing how to build him up and make him think it's his idea. I was actually shocked that they went that night.
Yeah, me too.
I thought that Fred would be like, you know, like I got shit to do.
Right. An opportunity needs to present itself, but I guess one did.
Well, all I can think is that then the whole concept that Fred is like, doesn't have a very good libido or wasn't really into this whole, I think he actually is very into everything.
Especially when there's a little risk involved.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it needs to be this amped up version, but I just mean like, you know, there's sort of like a lot of talk about whether or not, you know, he can really even perform previous episodes and stuff. So it was like, he's into all this. Definitely Nick was like supersonic pissed that he had to be the driver to this. I really got a little panicked about the idea that they were just going to go straight to the room. How in the world do you think that June was supposed to get down to the bar? Did you think that was going to happen?
Well, I knew that she basically pushed her luck when she asked about it twice. The commander figured it out, kind of. He figured out a version of what he thinks was happening at that point, but close enough to the truth that it could be very dangerous for her.
What did you think about the whole idea of them teasing Nick?
I thought it was shitty on June's part to play it up so much as she did.
What's up with that? Do you think that she just wanted to try to, I don't know if it was like a mean girl move of trying to get bonded with another person by putting down a third person together? Like, hey, both of us will completely make Nick feel like shit. And then somehow that bonds the two of us together.
She's definitely pissed at him from last episode. You know, the whole kiss off routine, basically. Right. I think this was furthering this character. And like you said, building a bond, like the way that she got the commander to say, you just need to chill, Nick. Like,
oh, yeah. It's a mean girl move.
He's never spoken so casually like that.
Right.
Or in slang that I can recall. That was creating a little something between at the cost of
Nick. Of everything with Nick. And then it amps up because then the commander feels the need to do it himself. Like he starts prodding at Nick without June even being a part of it. He's like, well, doesn't she look beautiful tonight? Oh, he can't handle you. Amped up really fast. And the only way we've ever seen the commander talk to Nick before this was, like you said, respectfully saying things like, you're a good guy, you know, all that kind of stuff. And this was like, he was really teasing him, you know?
Yes, he was.
And Nick definitely reminded him at that last minute about like, this was such a last minute trip. You should be careful. We don't know who's here. Again, I feel like that he was playing his game so that the commander's like, you're a good guy, Nick. You're always looking out for me. Like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It kind of is embarrassing to look at the commander and realize like every time the wind changes a little bit, he just goes with it. Oh, yeah, Nick, chill. Then 2 seconds later, you're such a good guy, Nick. He seems so weak and lame. Like he has no opinions of his own, like no actual feelings. Whatever someone says, he just is like, yeah. And like, you know, he just kind of follows what they're doing.
He does prove to be a pretty reactive guy as things turn out.
They chose to show the sex scene this time. Last time we had said, you know, we felt like it was a little unbelievable that they would have shown so many different sex scenes and then they wouldn't have shown this one. This is the sex scene I pretty much expected in the last episode. It was impersonal. She obviously was not enjoying it.
It looked rapey to me. I mean, she was crying and forcing herself to say things that he expected her to say back to him.
Right.
She looked very uncomfortable and he looked pretty oblivious to what
she
was giving off.
The only thing that he looked like was that he just wanted her to get into it. She had asked to come there, you know, and
he did ask her. You can be loud next time.
Well, and he was like looking at her face and then she realized he was looking at her face. And so then she was like, oh, yeah, you know, like kind of being like, oh, this is great. And so she did adjust. But it was like, again, I kind of feel a little bit like June gets into these situations and then doesn't even realize what situation she got herself into. I understand why she needed to do the Mayday stuff, but it's like she didn't really absorb the fact that like, oh, yeah, I'm going to have sex with him again.
she's gotten possibly to be too familiar with the idea of needing to let her mind wander during ceremony sex.
Right. I like that.
And perhaps that spilled over into this rendezvous to her detriment. She let her mind wander and he saw her wandering.
And that it was, you know, real quick where he was all, do you think I'm stupid and everything. I mean, it happened all real, real quick after that.
Okay, so we talked about this. How did he find out that she was a friend of Ruby / Moira's? The options are he noticed that she followed her into the bathroom last week, or he found out about June's secret trip from the room down to the Jezebel's dorm area. I voted for option B, but after we talked about it, it seemed highly implausible that he would have had enough contact to figure that out. And much more likely that he would have just noticed, hey, Ruby just went to the bathroom, you just went to the bathroom, and put it together like that.
I don't know. I think I like your initial response because they didn't show us how she got back in the hotel room. So, I mean, he knew she was gone from the hotel room. And then I assume there was some asking around or something.
That's what I was kind of just putting in to my initial idea of like,
that makes the best sense to me. I don't like it that they cut that all off, but I guess they had to cut it all off. And if we want to think it was B, then they had to cut all that scene off because otherwise there would be no surprise in this that he knew. So there had to have been something that happened that they just didn't show us.
Like the scene where she gets out of bed. Would you be surprised if it turned out that if they had let that scene run 2 seconds longer, he would have opened his eyes?
I wish that he had opened his eyes, to be honest with you. Because I think that that would have put me in a fearful place the entire time. And I wanted to be, you know, I wanted to be like nerved up about her getting back. And so when they didn't show it and they just went right to the alley, I was kind of like, that just seemed like a missed opportunity.
However it is he found out, Ruby's there in the room.
Rubes was really super pissed. I mean, this felt like not just a name, but almost like she was a split personality. I wondered if she was high or something, because this just didn't seem anything like Moira.
The person that she ran into in the dorm last week was, I think, in Moira's mind, supposed to be the last time that she ever saw Moira. You know what I mean? So seeing her again, seeing June again for Moira was like, I kind of mentally broke off from you because I'm so mentally into this existence right here and now that doesn't include you and thinking about Hannah and stuff like that. You're very unwelcome to me right now.
And the way that she delivered that message in this exchange was, you know, just really cold though. Just, you know, I'm a prisoner, I'm a whore, all this stuff. I mean, she was not the same kind of sitting on the mattress, acting almost like a sleepover, hugging and giggling a little with each other, you know, that kind of stuff that happened in the previous episode. It was laughing through tears, but they were still, it was like a reunion. And so this time, I think probably the fact that she got drug up to the room, I have to imagine that it wasn't a pleasant, like, hey, Ruby, you're picked next. Why don't you wander up on your own accord to room number 200, you know, and we'll talk to you later. I bet she was drugged there by a guy with a gun. And so the whole setup would have been scary for Ruby / Moira.
That's very true, because Waterford implied that he and Ruby had at least a prior tryst.
Yeah, super gross.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty gross. Also, I don't know enough people to intermingle their sexual relations with the people they know that they could be comfortable with saying, yes, I've had sex with this woman after I've just had sex with you just 15 minutes ago. Isn't that great? Don't you think I'm a great guy for telling you about that right now? I don't know any people like that, you know?
I think the point of it was not that. I feel like the point was to show the reach that he has within the building, but also within the society. So I don't think the point was to say I had sex with Moira, ha, ha, ha. It's like, I know all the girls here, June. Like, if you think that you can have anything in this land, this is mine. There's no part of you that is going to come into this building and take pieces of it for yourself. I can give you pieces. I can call Ruby up here for you to talk to. But you don't get to just go downstairs and have a conversation on your own accord. Hmm. Everything is going to be done by my say-so.
That totally matches the same guy that gave her magazines in previous episodes.
It exactly did, because he was like, don't you miss this?
Right.
Don't you want to do, you know, don't you want to have this? Don't you want to read all this kind of stuff? That, I mean, it was more about taking things away so that they could have things to dangle over their head.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it felt. Like, he understood that that friendship was worth something to her, but he still had to show he was in control of when and where and how he was ever, they were ever going to have that friendship.
June tries to get Moira to get the package from the bartender or something. She doesn't know all the details, but she knows she needs Moira's help. Moira's like, no.
Did you think that it was believable that Waterford would have gone and taken a shower and left them alone to chitty chat? Was that just the equivalent of the magazine? Like, what can two dumb girls get into trouble doing? I know, who cares?
That's not a great explanation, but that is what I think he thinks. They don't have anything that they could possibly do to him. No one would believe him anyway. One's a whore. So June knows all about pushing emotional buttons, it seems. Would that be where you would have gone? You said that we would find Hannah if you were June. It seems like that was like her last Hail Mary punch in the gut kind of move. Because if time was up, showers don't last forever. I guess you've got one last thing to do.
Yeah, I think it was a decent move to make, would just be remind her of who we used to be. Remind her, saying things like pinky promises and things like that in a world where you just say praise be and stuff like that. You know, I mean, pinky promises are a lost art in this place. And so I feel like she has to hear those words in order to feel that, oh yeah, you know, where'd we used to be and how did this used to work? And this was the time that, you know, we recognized that Hannah is the motivator for everybody. You know, Moira too, really. It was about finding the little girl and helping someone else. Again, I feel like it's that same thing. It's like when you feel like you're helping someone else, you can gather more courage. So Moira didn't have the courage by herself, but if she was doing something like trying to get the package out on behalf of June for the greater good of saving Hannah, then she was suddenly like, 3 times bigger and stronger.
But she doesn't feel that way right away.
They definitely bicker back and forth longer than I thought they were going to. And like I said, I kind of felt like Moira was high or something. Maybe Waterford had been like a super dick to her at like some other meetup because she was scared to be there, really scared to be there.
Before we leave this scene, I want to mention that this is definitely where we depart Moira's story from what happens in the book. When June goes back to Jezebel's in the book, Moira's just gone. No explanation. Don't know if she escaped. Don't know if she was killed. Just gone. And now we have a whole new story for Moira. So that's exciting for me.
I think so too. I think it's great.
All right. So we go home and everyone's sneaking back into their rooms. And June, this is the single flashback in the episode, was as she's sleeping, she's kind of dreaming of a time at the beach with Luke and Hannah and Moira. It's not a super flashback. It's just more dreamy, like, you know.
Right.
Doesn't get much of a reprieve before Serena's like waking her up.
I was
frantically.
So freaked out. Why did you think that Serena Joy was waking her up?
I thought because she was in trouble for something. Like, she had been found out
for the Jezebel's thing.
The commander had been found out. Something. I thought she was in trouble.
For sure. But it turns out that they need her help and they have to head over to the bridge. Now, I did not know what was going to really be going on here. We have Janine, and we need to back up a little bit for Janine and exactly what she had already endured in this episode. So, you know, she had gone through leaving Warren's house, which included this really screwy ceremony that they had to read some Bible passages, which somehow was sort of seemed like they were trying to make it like official that she was handing the baby over to them.
Right. And it was, could you see the way that the wife, I forget her name.
Naomi
just loathed the entire thing. Like the veneer of polish that she had over the hatred that she felt toward Janine eroded super quick.
Yeah, Aunt Lydia, her eyes were like pleading with Naomi the entire time. I mean, she badly wanted Naomi to just play the part, to allow Janine to be able to leave in a way that wasn't going to be a big scene. But that wasn't going to happen if Naomi was going to keep being a snot to her. Like, it just wasn't.
It's like the one moment that we've seen where the family offers the least bit of gratitude or respect toward the handmaid, and all they ask for is a nod, like a bow, you know, and that's all the handmaid gets, not even like a high five or anything.
Right. And definitely, I mean, you know, the part where the baby starts crying and, you know, Janine kind of backs up and explains, like, you know, you have to burp her during feeding. I recognize that as like a mom like needing to leave their child with somebody, and they're kind of nervous about the whole thing, and they start just kind of frantically spewing out those kind of one line things, like, you know, and they always like to sleep on the left side, and they have to have their teddy bear, and they, you just kind of start spewing out these kind of sort of, they seem disjointed comments about it, but really they've been running it in their head this whole time, like how they would want the child to be taken care of. I felt like when she says they need to burp her mid-feeding and Naomi is like, I know, and she's like really snotty. Oh boy, I felt like it was like, God dang, can you just give her a little bit of latitude here? Like, this is hard. And that was the look that I saw from Aunt Lydia. Like, she was like, come on, Naomi, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, finally we get like this cursory little like, you know, yes, okay, you know, of course. Like, and she kind of backs off a little bit. But did you think that Janine was going to hand the baby over at that point?
Janine and the baby, I think the show could do anything with at this point when I'm watching this episode. By that, I mean, they've shown us FGM, a very serious subject. They've shown us some mutilation here and there of other sorts. And so in my mind, Janine could have run away right then. Or she could have broken the baby's neck, or she could have handed the baby over peacefully like she did.
I agree. They have successfully made her a very loose cannon in that you don't have any idea what she could do. Now, I know you're kind of giving credit to the show, but I'm going to give credit to the actress and credit to the character that she has just proven to be so off base, you know, even from the first time we saw her when she was in the Red Center. And I said, read the room, Janine. Like, this isn't the time to act like that. You don't mouth back in this
Janine
situation.
Can't read the room, as it turns out.
She can't. And that's the whole thing. I feel like that's like her Achilles heel and perhaps her saving grace. Like, so she doesn't always understand when the situation is as serious as it is either.
No. Like when she comes outside. And she starts with her farewell routine like she's, you know, graduating or going to prom or some other happy kind of thing.
Boy, that was really upsetting. Now, I understood that, you know, Warren, I believe, had told her the entire time, you know, go through this process and we will be a family and we will run away. I do believe he told her those things.
Me too.
Now, I don't think that he ever intended to do it, of course, but I think he did it in the same ways that I think like Aunt Lydia does various things, you know, where she's just trying to calm, you know, the baby calf into the pen so that they can shut the door, you know.
Right.
It isn't so much about lying to her per se, as much as it is manipulating her into feeling malleable enough to actually go and do what they need her to do. Now, I think that they did not in any way understand the level that, again, Janine is loose cannon. So that part when she hops in the van and she goes, bye, like in that really, the only voice that came to mind was the Munchkins from Wizard of Oz when they're saying goodbye to Glinda. And they're like, bye, bye, goodbye. And she sounded exactly the same as them. And they're all kind of lined up in a similar way, if you remember.
Right,
because
yeah.
She kind of walks through their lineup
and
then goes. I don't know what the symbolism that is there. I encourage our listeners, if you know anything there, I think that the sentiment of there's no place like home is certainly huge in this, being in a land where everything seems screwed up and messed up. And
there is no home.
You can't figure out anything is huge.
People want to feel like there is a home, But for the handmaids, they just get shuffled around. She's just going to a new assignment. So there is no home, but she would still want to feel like there's a home because people, that's how people are wired.
So I do think that that point of home and not having a place to feel safe is a huge part of Janine's obvious undoing here. You know, she felt like she was finally settled in at the Warren's home. She's always been this strange duck, but I really feel like everybody needs that, you know, everyone needs that nest to be able to go back to.
I definitely know I do. Definitely think most people do. And the transient condition that they've placed on the handmaids has got to be yet another, I mean, it doesn't rank up quite as high as some of the other offenses, but it's got to be another way to keep them just sort of feeling off balance or insecure.
Well, because you can't make any inroads with anyone. You can't make any relationships with the other people in your house. You can't make any relationships with just even your circumstances, you know? Mm-hmm. And so you're right. It would make you continuously feel out of it.
Such as Janine. She now lives with the Monroes. Her new name is of Daniel.
Wow. Okay. So the way that they just ushered her right into the ceremony, did you get the idea that they literally took her from the front door to the bedroom? Because in all honesty, like she says, I should wait for him downstairs. I think they were supposed to go through the whole, like how we saw with June, where they were like, this is Alfred. This is Commander Waterford. This is Serena Joy. Remember that conversation in the living room?
I think they waited because it seemed like it was nighttime to me and it was daytime when they brought her in.
I honestly don't think she had like formally met him and had that conversation because she seemed so skittish and so scared. Like, I mean, she was like, shouldn't I be downstairs waiting, like talking to him? Because that wouldn't make sense. If this was ceremony night and everything, why would she say that?
When she was bringing Janine up to the house, she said, see how they wait for you? And they were both in the door. So he was home from work that day, I guess. So yeah, you might be right that they went right up. I mean, the wife, Mrs. Monroe
is what they said.
She was as high-spirited and good-natured as I could, as we've seen a woman. I mean, she was like, she was probably mentally, in my mind, thinking, we've got a fertile one.
We've got a good one,
a producer. So I'm excited to be a part of this.
And that's the thing, though. But that's the thing. That's what I mean. I think that they did just rush right into it. I think they just ran right to the bedroom because they were excited. It sounds messed up to say I don't fault them, but it's like they were overzealous about getting to the bedroom and doing this entire thing, which is where I feel like this is what caused their gigantic problem. Like they didn't allow her to adjust to the environment or anything at all, you know?
Did you notice that there was no Bible reading in their version of the ceremony?
I think they were all jazzed up. Like where was the house staff? Where was everybody? Like, you know, they didn't do the ceremony, which if you were Janine and she's like, come sit on the bed. And so she just sat on the bed like a normal person. And she's like, no, like, you know, lay down here in my lap. It was like, if you were Janine, wouldn't you be like, what the hell are we doing? Like,
yeah,
I don't get dinner. I like, what is happening right now? You know, like, I mean, they truly are treating her like absolute trash. Like, I mean, it's terrible. And I feel like the reason why they went through a lot of the trouble of showing us June being introduced to the house. And if you think about that, that was very methodical, meeting Mr. Waterford. And she like went through the course of like getting her room and all this stuff. And Janine, it was like, we saw her at the front door. We saw her in the bedroom. And I think that's actually how it went for her.
So Janine wigs out. She and
well,
who can
how would
blame
you
her?
Feel? Yeah, would I mean, do you think this is all justified?
In our world, Janine, as an adult, may be the sort of adult that needs another adult to look after her, you know, for you know, making sure that she goes to the doctor and takes care of herself, that kind of thing.
Now, let's talk about that for just a second because I didn't get the idea that she came in the red center like that person. I don't think that she was this person beforehand. I mean, I think you're seeing the effects of sort of like the Joker, like sort of like when they get in that like maniacal kind of place in their head where she's going crazy. I mean, this is what it looks like when someone's going crazy. I don't think she came in inept or incompetent. I think she came in seemingly like a very normal person.
I agree. I think that Janine, she was immature when she came in. And then she had her eye taken out, and then she started to deteriorate from there.
Yeah. So at this point, yeah, I mean, she is somebody who needs help. And I think that that's what Aunt Lydia sees. Like, she knows she is fragile, you know, her mind is very fragile at this point. And, you know, all that stuff about she's tougher than she looks and stuff. Maybe physically she's tougher than she looks, but mentally, I think she is just... I mean, she's cracking every single day.
So when I bring that up, what I mean to get around to is that even if you could think of a woman who you may not know her in your lifetime right now, but a woman who could, I don't know, rationalize her place in life and to become a handmaid and basically agree to try to have a baby with this couple for a little while, then agree to do it with another couple and just do that until who knows how long. If you could think of that kind of woman, Janine, I don't think has the mental competence to make that kind of rationalization in her own mind. You know what I mean?
Okay, so here's the thing. I mean, there are women who absolutely do that right now in our world. They're called surrogates. And they 100% agree of their own volition without being mentally impaired or in any way held against their will, where they choose to have a baby for a couple and then move on to another family, move on to another family. Now, it's the circumstances in which this is all happening that is breaking Janine down. The idea of having a baby for a couple isn't this wildly crazy idea. And I think that's where Margaret Atwood has gotten under people's skin, is because she's taking enough of a real thing and twisting the circumstances and making it just crazy or unbelievable, like, ah, I can't, no one could survive that situation enough. If there had been no such thing as a surrogacy situation, I could easily understand where people would be like, this makes no sense. Who goes around having babies for other couples? But we do have that in our current world. And since we do, it's like trying to tease out, well, what's the difference between a healthy surrogacy situation and what they're doing to Janine or any of the handmaids? What is the difference? And that's the part where, like, I think we do need to talk about that, because I think you're focused too much on Janine's mental stability. And what I'm saying is that I think that the way that they're handling it is what is busting her up. And that it would happen to anybody, even if you were a willing party, a surrogate to have children for various families.
Okay. Yeah, I am highly focused on Janine. She's made me very sad since the first time we met her. And I've been worried about her this whole time.
Paul really has, you guys. Like, this is the type of situation where when we're not watching the show, Paul is, like, worrying about Janine. Like, really, honestly. Like, well, that's the way we are. When we watched The Leftovers and Evie goes missing, we, honest to God, worried about how she was going to get her medication because she needed her medicine. And oh no, this is terrible. And we're those types of watchers where we absolutely get sucked in. I don't know if you guys feel the same way, but we're definitely like that. And in this case with Janine, she's so vulnerable. And you want to wrap a blanket around her and get her to a safe place so badly.
In a lot of ways, she's a grown-up with a child's emotional and mental capabilities.
Yeah.
And I know people like that. And to see Janine in this position, it's very... very painful and
frightening, because again, like we said, if there's such a thing as surrogacy already, and then what if you have someone who's mentally not able to, like you said, be a consenting adult
that's what I was getting at. Like, yeah. in our world, if you knew someone that was having a surrogate in their life, right, you'd think nothing of it. But if you met the surrogate and they were Janine, you'd think your friend was a fucking monster.
That's right. Because I agree what you're saying, because And here's the thing, again, for many of you guys who have just picked up our podcast, we have three special needs children, and that's what led us to podcasting, because we felt like we needed a way to talk about some of these issues, and we found through various TV shows that we were actually able to bring up a lot of issues. And one of the issues that we deal with is the concept of being a consenting adult and being a part of a sexual relationship. And what happens if you have some sort of mental impairment at all, whether it was by birth or for Janine, I feel it's something that was thrust upon her because of PTSD, you know, traumatic situation that happened to her. When you think about that, where is the line? Where is the line for people who have any type of what we would consider not typical consenting abilities? Are they allowed to have sexual relations? And it's a really big deal in the special needs community. It's a really big question mark. You know, can two people who have Down syndrome get married? You know, there's all these types of questions that are out there. And I think that Janine, obviously, this is circumstance where people have treated her badly, but there are circumstances where people have special needs because of a traumatic situation too. You know, a stepfather threw them down the stairs or shook the baby or whatever, and now they have these issues. And there's it's a really gray, fuzzy line about, like, well, what is consenting adult and what isn't? Obviously, in this scenario and how they're treating her and how they're passing her along and everything, this is clearly a situation of absolutely wrongdoing on the parts of the people who are in charge of this entire society. So I don't want to say, you know, this is a little unclear to me. Had she been a healthier person or whatever, is this okay? But I think the concept of having someone who has any type of mental impairment at all being a part of a sexual act is now really, like, right in our faces, you know, and she's scared and she runs and she hides and all that kind of stuff. And it is extremely disturbing given that we also have special needs children.
For those of you out there that this is new to, this is something that's in our face all the time. And now it's in your face with Janine. And she run and hide.
And we should clarify, like, the reason why it's in our face all the time is because our children are now teenagers. And, you know, there is that sort of that still that question mark about, like, okay, we're getting older. What is acceptable? I'm like, what can they handle? And what is okay and what is not okay? And that kind of thing. And we're not at the point yet where they're interested in guys and girls kind of thing. But when that day comes, there is that, I'm not sure if you can handle, you know, the emotional, mental parts that come with a physical relationship. And that's the part where I feel like Janine is putting that right in everyone's faces. You know, what happens if you take a person who is mentally frail and you then create these circumstances that are, even if you're healthy, like June, in theory, would break you down, you know? Mm-hmm. But in this case, you know, like you said, Mrs. Monroe's so nice. She's so kind. We're in this together. Mm-hmm. You know, what if you're saying the right things like that, but the act itself is so
monstrous.
Yeah. And like more than she can comprehend is what I'm trying to say. You know, it's like, it's like above, it's like, what are you talking about? What are we even doing? It's like, she never understood what was happening in the first place. That is a very, very complex conversation. And I want to really put, like, a huge blanket over everything what we've just talked about with Janine by saying, you know, this is a very touchy subject. And if you yourself have special needs children, or if you have special needs members in your family, this is a very individual, very personal situation. And of course, we're only getting a very small slice of the pie with Janine. You know, we only see her for these really tiny segments. Mm-hmm. We don't know what she was like before. So we are sort of
filling in the blanks.
Yeah. And extrapolating on her story and what's going on with her and how she might be feeling or thinking. I guess that's our disclaimer,
right?
For, like, you
don't,
know,
don't crucify us if
please
we're making
don't.
Up the wrong
and,
stuff.
And it's just something that it's probably not something that the average person thinks about, you know, sexuality for a person who has any type of mental health problems. What does that look like? And how does that play out? And that part with Janine, even if she had been healthy to begin with, she is now somebody who has suffered from, you know, a huge traumatic situation. Now what? Now what's acceptable? And should she be treated any differently now or protected?
I believe the answer is yes, because she cracks, Lane.
Yeah. So it turns out that, you know, when we were talking about June earlier, she was being brought to the bridge to talk to Janine because Janine has managed to get back to the Warren's house, which, you know, goddamn, Paul, bravo to Janine. Look at her. You know, we've got handmaids who can't seem to get themselves, you know, down to the driveway. She's just like, fuck all you guys. She's out of there. And when Janine makes up her mind, think about that. Like, they knew she was having a hard time in that bedroom. You would have almost thought they would have called the black vans or called Aunt Lydia right then, right?
Yeah.
But somehow she just like probably went to bed and they just all went about their business. Like, they closed their eyes that night. That was a dumb decision. Mrs. Monroe and Daniel, y'all were really underestimating Janine.
Highly. Because she snatches Charlotte.
Dude, she got back into Warren's house.
And these places are patrolled by guardians.
Men with like machine guns outside. Holy Hannah, Janine is like miraculous, right?
She's like a ghost. And she sweeps in, gets the baby, goes to this bridge. And that is where June comes to try to talk her down. And again, this was kind of like at the beginning of the episode where I didn't know what could happen because I felt like anything could happen.
Yeah.
And so.
Right. She could have broken the baby over her knee. She could have just thrown the baby and run. Anything could happen.
So there were three options. Everybody lives. Maybe there's four options. Everybody lives. The baby goes in. Janine goes in. They both go in. Right.
Okay. Yeah.
Obviously, we want everybody to live. June tries to talk her down with talk of things to come. Change is a coming.
Now, what did you think about the idea of her saying things like that in front of all of those people?
Super bold, because, you know, she wants to be part of the change with her volunteering for May Day, but her mission was a failure, according to what's happened so far in the episode.
Do you think that the other people could hear her? I mean, I know she asked for everyone to back off, and I mean, huge moment there, huge moment about asking Warren and Naomi to back off, and Warren being like, I'm not backing off, and who do you think you are? And Fred stepping in to say, give her a chance, Warren. Oh shit. That part, Serena's look was like, what now? Did you just completely speak up on behalf of the handmaid? I'm positive that this is like a gigantic moment for SJ.
And I see it as two-sided. Yes, SJ didn't like what he did, but I think he was speaking up for the rest of the commanders because Janine had already yelled out all this stuff that Warren had made her do. Everybody knows it at this point.
Right.
So he didn't want the rest of the commanders to look any worse by being associated with this clown Putnam who's been called out and caught in front of everybody else. So as I learned from Homer Simpson, the best thing you can do in these moments is keep your fool mouth shut. And so Waterford was trying to get Putnam to see that wisdom.
Wife eyes, I'm just letting you know, she saw that as he was defending and speaking up for another woman. And it don't matter, friend. I hear everything you're saying. Maybe he could have worded it in a different way. But when he said, give her a chance and stuff, buddy. I'm just telling right. you.
He would have needed to say, you look like a fool. Shut up. You needed to say something more like that.
Or just something like, we've got to do everything that's possible. Just back off. You know, we've just got to try anything to make this situation better. So, you know, something. But when he actually says, like, give her a chance.
She's not even supposed to be a her to him, right?
Mm-mm. Nope.
Maybe there were a couple guardians that were close. And there seemed to be a couple of aunts in the background there that were.
Definitely Lydia.
Close-ish.
When she was screaming, hooray, hooray. She was pulling her best Mrs. Garrett.
I don't think anyone overheard. And if they did,
I want to think it was like a windy bridge up there, you know, where it's kind of hard to hear. You know, that's in my mind. That's what I imagine. I feel like they use the exact same logic on her that has been used on Janine the entire time. You know, the idea of like, hey, when this is all over, we'll go out and all that stuff. I mean, it was the same backing the calf up into the pen. What was intriguing was that at the last second, Janine's like, no one would want to dance with me, like because of her eye. It was the first time that she like turned away and was like, you're not going to be able to shove me back in the pen, you know? And so that's when June had to take the whole other approach and be all like, you have to give your daughter a chance. But realizing Janine like wasn't going to be shoved in a pen again. It just isn't going to happen again. I'm proud of Janine for recognizing the situation and being like, you know what? Physically or mentally, emotionally, physically, right. I'm not going to go back to normal. So
are they handing out eyes with the normalcy that you're promising June?
And psyches, you know, like she's can't go back anymore. And so even talk of it, things moving on and going back, that's no longer comforting at all.
But she agrees that the daughter still has a chance.
So she hands that baby over, right? And did you, when the part when she said, make sure she knows I love her and all that, did you think that meant like, oh, for sure, she's going to jump now?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I didn't think that there was any chance she was coming down off that thing.
The boat down there was like ready in like 1 second to like scoop her right up, man. The pokers.
Yeah, if you're going to jump from a short distance like that, you need to make sure that you go head first. That will kill you.
Oh, dang.
But if you belly flop like she did, it's just going to ruin your day. I mean, it wasn't far enough.
Yeah.
Ugh. Yes.
What else freaks me out? Ugh, it gives me the willies.
You pointed out pretty appropriately that there was a lot of activity on top of the bridge, what with the pointing and the scurrying about. But there was nothing to be done up there. Obviously, she's over the bridge. It's over up here.
Yeah. But everybody's faces were, you know, terror, you know, that she had jumped. It was a little bit of a win for Janine because they all actually cared about her for like 1 second, like her for like 1 second, you know, like a human being just jumped off the bridge. You know, their faces were all like.
So in the hospital room, which is the next scene, two things that I thought initially were A, she's in a vegetative state, and B, that although you pointed out that her legs appeared to be spread on the bed, and they definitely were, I kind of thought that might have been more like tying her down. Even though vegetative state doesn't really line up with that, still, you never know.
No, yeah, so, restrained. That makes sense.
I mean, I guess it fits with the world that having a mindless baby vessel would work for their purposes. The whole thing was icky, right?
Absolutely. I definitely didn't know what state she was in at that point. They didn't give us any indicator. You know, Aunt Lydia being by her bedside was like, again, she's such the Don Knotts of the show. Like she's on the bridge. She's in the hospital. She's here. She's there. She's everywhere. Mm-hmm. I kind of thought they should have had like, I don't know, one other aunt in the room. Like right. They really need to introduce a couple of other people.
Aren't you the principal of the Red Center?
Aren't you also the main teacher at the Red Center? Aren't you also doling out punishment? Aren't you also like, I mean, she's just freaking everywhere, dude, everywhere. I was unsure about what exactly Aunt Lydia was doing there, what she was going to say. And the fact that she was just there to basically, you know, sort of give like a half-hearted kind of prayer and say, you stupid girl. I don't know what to think. I feel like Janine's story and this one just really felt like, I don't want to say anything that's like a joke because everything I want to say is like a real downer or like nothing, like there's nothing, I don't know how to say it. Like it just leaves you so.
Well, it's a weird position because you normally in stories, when you see a person who's in the protagonist type slot, definitely not an antagonist, you want them to come out ahead. You want them to live. But in this case, you're kind of caught thinking, oh, I wish she would have probably been better off dead.
And maybe that's the thing. Maybe that's the feeling I'm trying to describe. Like, I just kind of felt helpless by the end of it. She can't even get out by jumping off the bridge. You know, like nothing can happen. And maybe that's even what Aunt Lydia was kind of saying, was sort of like, you know, you think you can escape and there's like no chance. You have no chance of escaping.
Because although we don't apply medical technology to increasing the odds of giving birth, we'll use it for everything else.
Apparently, that's like the strangest thing. Let us talk finally about the last main gal in this episode, which was Serena. We had some real interesting moments with her. They were just snippets, and I feel like she would have been easily lost in this episode. If you were very focused, you said the name of this episode is The Bridge. The point is that Janine jumped off the bridge and that's what I'm watching. And that's what I'm paying attention to. Then I would really invite you to watch it again and really watch, again, thinking of the bridge as more of that intermittent stage going from one place or sort of mindset to another. I think that Serena Joy really exemplifies the concept of the bridge and the moment that she really switched over here as well.
Yeah. So in the beginning, I think she is still, I don't know if she ever has totally believed in the Gilead system. She's very hard to make out. She says all the things that would make you think that she does, you know, like she's a true believer, but we know how she kind of got conned and screwed out of
I'm a little confused about what you're saying because she wrote these rules.
Yeah, but it's like she didn't know that she was writing them for her, you know?
It doesn't matter. You would believe in them if you wrote them. And so the fact that they apply to her, it sucks. Sucks to be her. But to say that she doesn't believe in Gilead, I don't think that's it. I don't think that's it. I think it's that she expects Naomi Putnam to be as devout as she is, to believe in Gilead in the same way, in the same intensity that she believes in Gilead. Naomi doesn't. Naomi wanted a baby. And maybe not even, for God's sake. I mean, honestly.
Right. She's pretty terrible at having one.
I mean, I don't even know if she wanted a baby. I'm not sure what she wanted. I mean, she seems like a very...
Well, babies mean status. So maybe status.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I'll go with that. She just doesn't... So going on that walk with Mrs. Putnam, they do run across a third woman character there that a lot of people are saying was probably an econo-wife.
From the book, econo-wives are women that are, they fill into this other kind of category, right? Where they're not married to powerful men, but they've been assigned to more run-of-the-mill guys, like drivers, butchers, you know, that kind of level. And I don't mean level in like any kind of insulting way. I mean, in their society, they definitely
not have military, that's it.
Well, not government. How about that?
Okay.
Kind of wives, but they are assigned. They're not like handmaids. They're not really expected to become pregnant, but I guess they are meant to, I don't know, occupy the non-governmental men. I'm not sure. And they are not really expanded on in the book. They're just kind of mentioned. And okay. With this woman, she could be a Martha, but Marthas are usually pretty dang busy during the day.
No, I think that I think she's probably this version of this Econo wife, because how when she's trying to see the baby, I think that the whole reason why the guardian was like, get along, was Serena Joy says, you can't be too careful. Like, I think that it was about stealing the baby, about like having the baby for herself. And that's not something a Martha would do, in my opinion. That's something that would fit more in the Econo wife kind of scenario, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So what did you think about this dynamic between her and Naomi, and how Naomi was, you know, really quite a jerk about Janine and everything, and Serena Joy's response to it all?
Serena Joy seems to be sort of a hanger-on with this baby situation with the Putnams. You know, like, I don't know that she's actually been invited over on Naomi's part, you know? So now she's getting kind of a lot of free advice from childless Serena Joy about things going on in her house. And I don't think Naomi's like a great person or anything like that, but I do get the idea that perhaps this is getting to be like, all right, give me some space here, SJ.
Yeah, I agree with you. And even the idea that, like, you know, Naomi thinks that, you know, Alfred's situation is so great, and, you know, oh, you're so lucky that you have Alfred. It's like, it's all weird, you know. Everybody has got this, like, you know, your relationship is different than my relationship. My relationship is worse than yours, and yours is better than mine. Like, kind of attitude, even though it's like, no, everybody sucks. Every single person's situation sucks in a terrible way.
Yeah.
And for all different reasons and all different situations. But no, like, that attitude is like, that's not true.
I thought it was extra sad to see that Serena Joy was knitting baby stuff while Fred and June are off at Jezebel's. I don't really feel like bad for her because I kind of hate her. But how did you feel seeing her knit baby stuff?
The first thing that struck me was that every time that we've seen a baby, they're all dressed in white. And the baby stuff was like brown or something like that. And she put something in it and wrapped it up and put it away. And I kind of felt like it was like, I don't know, maybe every month she makes some sort of like, I don't know, almost like a, I don't want to call it like a death moment or something, but that makes no sense. No baby would use what she made in any way. They're all dressed in white all the time. Every child has always been all dressed in white. So this brown or dark colored whatever it is she's making, I think symbolizes something, the grief and the sadness part of it all in a different way. So putting in that hope chest, and obviously she was crying and everything. I mean, I think we got the idea. I was really surprised to see her go try to find a drink and have to dig around in the... I was surprised they had anything.
Well, it wasn't out for show, but yeah, I was also surprised. I kind of thought the country was officially dry, but...
Well, I mean, no. Commander has like a cart in his office and always has, but to have it in the kitchen, who would that... supposed to be accessible for?
It's not, I don't think, supposed to be out. It's Rita's secret stash, perhaps.
I think it's SJ's secret stash.
Secret in the kitchen?
I don't think that Rita would expose that she had it. Do you?
Rita made the offer, you know, something with a bit more flavor.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, what did you think of this conversation between Rita and SJ and how much Rita says? Did you think that SJ was going to continue to have this conversation with her, or was going to kind of turn on her and get nasty?
Well, for one, I didn't think Rita was old enough to have a 19-year-old son. But then after that, SJ's response of just spouting out that dogmatic Gilead bullshit, I thought was just a smack in the face for Rita.
It reminded me of this Gilmore Girls episode when one of Rory's suite mates at Yale has a bet going on where with her boyfriend, where now she can only speak in, or he can only speak in cliches because he lost the bet. Like every single thing that comes out of his mouth is like, you know, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy, like that kind of crap, like just over and over again. And that is how Serena Joy, like her dialogue seems to be written. Like they just print out a page of cliched, biblical, you know, just these kind of, they don't really mean anything, but it's like you could just plug them in anywhere.
Yeah.
There's also like a Facebook thing, a video where this guy's like going around a mall and he just uses Bible verses for everything. And it's hysterical because it's like, I mean, he's shopping, but he's like using Bible verses to like say like whether he wants something or doesn't want something. It's really funny, but it's just this idea of like, sure, you could plug it in to mean anything. You could plug it in to mean that this dress is ugly, or you can, you know, it's so how you take it, you know, in the moment.
If someone said that's shit to me, I think all I could do is just be quiet. That would be the best move I could make.
Yeah.
Just be quiet, because I mean, it seems so insulting for you to try to pander to me about the loss of my kid.
To me, it seems uncaring. Like, it seems like you didn't even absorb what I said. You know, you're just like, it's like that Hallmark, you know, we send you our thoughts and prayers. Like, I mean, it's like without even thinking at all, you're just spewing out
what's expected.
These phrases. Yeah. They're not what you really think. They're not what you really, you know, feel. It's just random. This drinking, I think, gives her a little liquid courage, no?
A little bit. For the next scene where she basically catches Fred sneaking back into the house, ostensibly upstairs from his office where she wants to believe he was. However, he manages to turn her around, like, go back to sleep.
What do you think about it, though? I mean, she obviously sat there waiting for him on the steps.
She's starting to get her suspicions. There was conversation on the Facebook page a few episodes ago when they showed the hanging first handmaid, and whether or not Serena's comment to the commander about, well, what do you expect to happen? What was that about? I believed at the time that she was just referring to the crazy laws that he helped enact. But there were a lot of women on the page who were like, no, she knows what happened. She knows that he probably took her to Jezebel's and gave her all this special treatment, and that probably fed into this suicide somehow. And now I'm seeing, yeah, that's probably true. Like, she did probably know about the first handmaid, but just hoping that he got his shit together. And even though they probably didn't talk about it at all, mm-hmm. And she was just hoping that things were going better this time. But now she's starting to see the cracks, suggesting, no, things are going exactly the way they did before. Not that she wants June to survive. It's just she wants June to make that baby. So the next time we see Serena post-bridge is when they are taking Putnam away. And she is there kind of consoling Naomi with talks, but not really. I mean, if
she's kind of being just like what you said about that sort of unwanted advice kind of person lingering around, like
let's hope none of this blows back on you.
I know. What the hell? Or sort of that, you know, stiff upper lip kind of like, this is going to be a hard time to live without your husband. It's like, get out of my house. You know, like, this is insane. And like, the last thing I need is you hanging around here telling me what's what.
That's the response Naomi generates.
I was like, yes, because she was like, everyone knows what happened with your first handmaid. Like, why don't you go clean up your own house? Worry about your own husband. Ooh, that is the kind of like smackdown that SJ needed to finally be like, all right, you know, it's one thing for me to be humiliated night after night in my own home, but now the freaking neighbors know, you know, now I'm just a laughing stock, you know, and she's done, D-U-N, done.
So she goes to check shit out in Fred's office. That would be the place to start, obviously, and there's plenty of sins hidden around in there.
And I think it's more than that. It's that she is done respecting his boundaries. Like, him saying, this is my office, and like locking the door, fuck all that. Like, I'm gonna kick the door down. I would have loved to see her kick it in and be like, it's over. It's over. Your secrets, your shit. I don't care exactly what I find in here, but I'm gonna walk in here anytime I want. These doors stay open, you know, like this is over, you know? And I appreciated that. I really, really appreciated that.
All right, the last scene we need to talk about is Moira getting her groove back. She decides to go through with a new version of the toilet tank metal arm sharpening plan. And this time, I'm pretty sure she cut that dude's throat.
Oh, absolutely.
She does, but she does the same thing. She puts on a disguise, takes the keys, and goes. And it was like, good for you, Moira.
Wasn't that wonderful? Yeah, that wonderful? I had like the biggest.
This show is lean on hope.
Biggest, you know? biggest smile. That was amazing. Now, the most amazing part of Moira's story is, of course, not just taking off in the truck, but the fact that she did get the package to June.
That makes me wonder how many hours are in the nights in Gilead, because you'd have to go to Jezebel's, have your encounter, come to Jesus, arrange for the package to be sent to the butcher get it. And cause that, I think she goes to the store like later on that morning, you know, cause she's still kind of dazed from what just occurred. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think so.
It's highly organized shit.
So did Moira actually drop the package to the butcher, you think? Is that how it made it there? I kind of think it did, now that I realized that she had the ability to drive the truck.
That could be, because the only other thing, I mean, the only other car we know that was coming back to this part of town was Nick, and Nick would have just given it to her.
No. This has nothing to do with Nick.
No. So I don't know.
I'm going with that she drove it. That's how it got to the butcher, that she drove it somewhere to another point person and got it to him. Like, whomever, when she got the package from Rachel and then really, I mean, that maybe that was even the initial thing, was like she was going to bust out and get this package. And maybe she didn't even know how far she was going to get after that. Mm-hmm. But that the idea of just, you know, getting it that far was huge. What did you think about her note? The praise be, bitch. Here's your damn package. XOXO Moira.
It told me that Moira's back. That Moira, person she had become at Jezebel's, is no more.
I think even the fact that it was signed Moira was like, Ruby no longer. You know, mm-hmm. Ruby's gone. And that was like, hooray. So I'm super duper excited for Moira, and I'm excited for the rest of the season. I know that this is going to be a huge major number 10 finale.
For my own self, my smarty pantsness about having read the book has pretty much run dry. So now we're starting to see new stuff, and that makes me very excited to see what comes next. Looking forward to it. See you next time.
Catch us on iTunes or your preferred podcast software, our website, dailyreview.com, that's D-A-L-E-Y review.com, Facebook or Twitter, or wherever you find us. Please leave us a comment and a rating to let us know what you think of the show.
Thanks for listening, pod people. Thanks for listening to my mom and dad.
You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. Just go home, folks.